and as a foul smell emanates from the open spout. The figure that steps into view is dressed in black, moving so fast I'm uncertain if perhaps I'm still dreaming. They smell of incense and burnt wood. The cell door opens, the lock dropping to the ground with a clatter. I retreat back, the pot still held in front of me. I wonder if I should swing at the body or dump the contents on the head. The figure in black pauses, and fingers reach under the wooden mask, pulling it away. Dark eyes, long lashed, stare back at me wearily. The scar down her throat, half healed, the one I gave her. Ruyi, handmaiden to the princess, presumed dead, standing before me, reeking of magic. I owe you my life, she says. You can put that down. I mean you no harm. I hesitate, then slowly place it at my feet. I was told you were dead. I thought it explained Jin's absence tonight. Thought she was lost to her grief. I don't believe in ghosts, but she stands here before me. She lied, sent me away to heal and make preparations. She steps forward, frowning. But before we continue, I have to ask you this. Where do your loyalties lie? Her hand rests on the hilt of her sword. A promise and a threat. I stare back at her. I suppose I could lie, say something pretty and useless that she wants to hear. But I've always been a terrible liar, and I'm tired of lying now. My loyalty rests with the ruler who will protect their people from harm, I tell her. With someone who does not use human lives as pawns. Ruyi stares back at me for a moment, then smirks, her hand dropping away from her sword. She was right. You do not shy away from the truth. Even though you should have been dead 10 times over by now, for some reason the stars shine upon you. I would disagree, considering my current predicament. Where's the princess? I ask instead. Confined to her rooms? Ruyi says. Chancellor Zhou says it's to keep her safe, but most likely it's to keep her unaware of your swift execution at dawn. If Jin is not on the side of the Chancellor, then it means she's unprepared for what is coming. You have to get her out of the palace, I say urgently. The soldiers from the Emerald Isles are inside the capital. The magic ripples around her. You saw this? They came with the governor of Su. He found me not long after the officials were poisoned. You have to come with me, Ruyi tells me, eyes brilliant even in the dark. I can't. You have to get him out. I shake my head and gesture to Wenyi's form in the other cell. Get him help and then return for me later. Ruyi's face twists, her annoyance apparent. We have no time for this, she snarls. But she turns on her heel and heads to the other cell, crouching before Wenyi's unconscious form. She puts her hand on his shoulder and I wait for him to move, to recognize that I kept my promise. But Ruyi narrows her eyes. Her fingers go to his neck, checking for a pulse. She looks up and tells me everything I need to know with a gentle shake of her head. I am too numb to scream, but I commit him to memory. Another name to add to the list. Another innocent life lost to these courtly games. Someday, I will avenge them all. Chapter 45. I try to empty whatever remains in my stomach into that pot, but end up dry retching instead. Ruyi returns to my side and places her hand on my shoulder, a reassuring presence. I can feel the magic thrumming off her, from the heat of her hand through even the layers of my tunic. She feels like she's vibrating from within, a string pulled too taut. I stand up and press my hand to her forehead. She tries to flinch away, but I've already felt how her skin burns. Someone filled her with too much magic, and it's tearing her apart from the inside. There is something familiar, though, about that scent, and how the magic inside me acknowledges it in response. Lian sent you, I say, and she nods. Come with me. There's nothing left for you here. She offers me her cloak, and I accept it, wrapping it around myself. I take one last look at Winnie's body and mumble a phrase of the funeral rites, hoping a part of his soul will find its way back to Rauhe and back to his family. I try not to look at the bodies of the guards, the blood pooling beneath them. But still the twinge of guilt remains. More blood, more death. I brought Ruyi back to life, only to have her empty out the souls of others. Whose life? Whose death? I concentrate on putting one foot ahead of the other through the tunnels of the palace. The farther we walk, the heavier her weight leans on me, trying to keep herself upright. Deep in the twists and turns of the tunnels, we trudge on, but she stumbles more often than she should, and I know she doesn't have much time left. She seems to know it herself, hurrying forward until we stop before another series of rings on the wall. She pulls them in a sequence, then a small door slides into view. We tumble back into a familiar residence, the Dowager Empress Wu Yang gazing at us with reproach from the wall. Princess Jin leaps to her feet when she sees us stagger inside. She's dressed in plain clothes, prepared for travel. "Everything is ready?" she asks, already at Ruyi's side. Ruyi nods. The princess touches her hand to her bodyguard's forehead, concern evident. "You're burning up," she scolds. The way Ruyi looks back at her is too intimate, and I turn away, not wanting to intrude on their privacy. They exchange a few more words in low voices before Jin calls me over. "Can you do something for her? I'm not sure she can travel in this state." "I'm fine," Ruyi brushes her away, but then struggles to right herself. "We should have just left. She saved your life. I made her a promise." Jin's eyes meet mine. "I don't forget my debts." I'm already rummaging in her drawers and shelves. "She's pushed it too far. I need something to expel the magic from her." Jin nods. "Anything you need. You'll find an assortment of tea leaves in there." Sweeping aside the fabric and the papers, I pull out as many jars and pots as I am able to. I open each pot, sniffing what's contained within, returning what I do not need. "Ning?" I turn to see Ruyi sway, Jin struggling to hold her up. I quickly assist the princess in lowering her down to a chair. Ruyi groans and drags her hand across her mouth. It comes away smeared with blood. It's disconcerting to see a fearless woman appear so uncertain, and with a pang in my chest, I think about Lien somewhere in the distance, anchoring the magic. I hope she's safe. "What's wrong with her?" the princess demands. "Lien's ability," I explain quickly, continuing to set up the ritual. "It always has a cost. It's dependent on the ability of the Shen Nongshi who casts it, as well as distance and duration. If the receiver pushes the limits too far, the magic turns on them too. She ran a horse to death getting from Kala to the palace after she regained enough strength to move." Jin smooths a hair around Ruyi's face. "She showed up right before the banquet. She wanted me to leave, but when I found out about the order for your execution, I asked her to get you." I tell her of my discoveries while waiting for the tea to steep, about the governor and his companions from Lizhou, the infiltration of the city guards. But Jin's reaction is not as I expected. She looks resigned. "It's sooner than I expected, but I knew they were coming. I knew the chancellor was involved when Ruyi was attacked while performing an investigation on my behalf, struck by the poisoned arrow. He was the only other person who was aware of her mission. I sent her away in order for him to think I was unprotected, easier to manipulate. Now is the time to strike, to finish what my uncle started." I pour the tea, brewed strong, the fragrance wafting from the cup. Osmanthus flowers and tangerine peels, stiff with sugar, begin to soften in the water. When it is done, I tip it into Ruyi's mouth, and this time she takes it without hesitation. They trust me, even with all those accusations against me, and I am thankful for it. The shift happens easily now, strengthened by my previous contact and Ruyi's willingness. An echo of Lien's magic, contained within her, answers my own. As if trimming an unruly shrub, I take some of the magic into myself, transferring a fraction of that potent power into me, the speed and the strength, easing the burden on Ruyi's body. Her eyes grow unfocused, but she breathes easier. "Can you stand?" I ask her. She nods and gets to her feet unsteadily. "You're going to feel weak until you get a full night's rest. You cannot exert yourself again, not even to defend her life from an assassin." I tilt my head toward the princess, and Ruyi manages a small smile. "The magic could burrow even deeper, somewhere I may not be able to reach," I add, but I doubt she will heed my warnings if Jin's life is at stake. "I'll help her." Jin ducks under Ruyi's arm and holds up the taller girl, and I hook my elbow against her other arm to steady her on the opposite side. The princess sweeps aside a silk hanging on the wall and presses the hidden panels until the mechanisms groan behind the wall. She lights a torch using the brazier and passes it to me to hold. We support Ruyi through the tunnels, making slow but steady progress. We make turn after turn, until Jin holds up her hand, bringing us to a stop. On the other side of the wall, we hear movement. Boots against the ground, metal brushing against metal as they march. I suspect they may be able to hear my heart beating so violently in my chest. But in time, their steps soon pass without cries of alarm, and we continue until we reach a doorway that leads to a grove of bamboo. The servants' quarters. I discard the torch into a rain barrel, not wanting the light to attract attention out in the open. A cart waits for us at the gate, filled with large pots, a sleepy-looking donkey tied to it. Jin heaves Ruyi onto the cart, and I pull myself up next to her. Sniffing the air, I smell wine. A head pops out from under the blanket. I barely manage to stifle a surprised shriek, and even Jin pulls a dagger and points it at the figure in the dark.
"It's me, it's me,"
Tiang whispers, waving his arm above his head. I pull him to me in a crushing hug, refusing to acknowledge his protests. "How did the guards not find you?" I grab hold of him by the shoulders, surveying him from head to toe to make sure he's not hurt in any way.
"Small Wu made me hide in the chicken coop and made a big ruckus to lead the guards away,"
Tiang said, sniffling.
"There was only enough room to hide me, no one else. I stayed very quiet, and then I ran into Guard Hu. Grandmother always says I can trust Guard Hu," he states with the confidence of young children. "He told me to hide here, and the princess would come and find me. And now here you are."
He tries to smile at Jin, but doesn't quite succeed. I give the princess a look over his head, and she nods, confirming that Guard Hu is the one who made the arrangements for leaving the palace.
"You did very well," I tell him.
His lower lip quivers, and I can see he is trying his very best to hold himself together.
"Will grandmother be safe?"
he whispers. Jin steps closer and kneels until she is at his eye level. "We have to leave the palace right now. Your safety depends on it. But I promise I will make every effort to make sure your grandmother is safe as well."
"Thank you,"
Chiron gulps, wiping away tears, trying to look as dignified as possible. I squeeze him again, just to be sure he knows he is not alone. We set off for the tea house district, with only the clopping of the donkey's hooves to accompany us. The cart carries us past shuttered businesses and quiet residences. But even now, somewhere around the hour of the thief, the tea houses are still ablaze with light. Pulling into an alley, we tie the donkey up to a post behind Peony House and ascend the back stairwell. I know the four of us are a conspicuous group, and I cannot help but continually check over my shoulder. Jin knocks at a set of doors on the second level, and we are admitted to a private room. Looking around, I can see it's an understated but tastefully decorated receiving room. A man and a woman are the only occupants, and they bow to greet us. The man is not much older than my father, with lines around his eyes, showing he has led a life full of smiles. The anxious-looking woman next to him, probably his wife, reminds me of the way Mother would hover around Father when she believed he was doing something unwise. With our ragged appearance, Ruyi appearing as if she's on the verge of collapse, I can see we are a reasonable cause for alarm. Jen quickly gestures for them to rise, dismissing the need for court niceties. Tian and I maneuver Ruyi to sit heavily on a stool. "Official Qiu," she acknowledges with a nod. "Madam Sun." The official's attention swings to me.
"And this is?"
"She will become my Shennongshu when I reclaim my court," Jin says. "Even though I know she may not have an empire to rule if everything unravels in the coming weeks, it shows me she still remembers her promise."
"I understand."
He nods, then returns to the business at hand. "The person you have requested to meet is waiting for you in the next room."
"One more thing," Jin says. "I know I have asked more of you than you're obliged to give, but our efforts have put this boy in danger. We have to move him away from the palace for his own safety. Can you place him under your protection?"
Tian looks up at Official Qiu, trying to maintain his composure. He manages, except for his quivering lower lip.
"Yes, of course."
The wife swats her husband's arm, not even waiting for his response.
"We will take him. A child should always have a home. Come with me. Auntie will get you some treats."
She puts her hand on his shoulder and Tian looks to me for permission. I give him a nod. Even though I wish I could keep him with me, I know there are more dangerous roads ahead.
"Go on,"
I encourage him.
"I'll see you again."
He follows her, and I am happy that at least he will be well taken care of.
"Now if you will follow me."
Official Qiu pulls aside the heavy tapestry, revealing a doorway.
"We will speak to the astronomer." Chapter 46.
The man who waits for us on the other side has a thin beard and is dressed in plain white robes. A white jade pendant swings from his sash when he stands and bows to us.
"Astronomer Wu."
Jin clasps his hands with warm familiarity, and he returns her greeting with a fond smile.
"Please, sit."
He gestures to a round table surrounded by stools. I take my leave toward the next room to assist Ruyi, but the astronomer calls out to me.
"You should hear this as well, daughter of Shen Nong."
With hesitation, I perch myself on the edge of a stool, not sure why I have been asked to stay. The number of astronomers in the empire is fewer than the Shen Nongshu listed in the Book of Tea, but no one is certain how many are in their ranks. I never thought I would be permitted to be in the presence of one, much less attend one of their readings.
"I am thankful you made the effort to meet me at risk to yourself,"
Jin says.
"It will not be forgotten."
"You have a hard path ahead, child,"
Astronomer Wu says with great solemnity.
"I'm not sure it will be a kindness for you to know what the stars have intended for you. I admit, I have considered encouraging you to walk an easier path."
Jin scoffs at the thought. "I am a daughter of the Li family. I will not turn to the easier path just to save my own life."
"Although we are not like the Shen Nongshu, able to see the threads of a person's possible future from a single cup,"
he spares me a glance,
"we can see the courses of kingdoms and empires. We see the paths of multitudes, each life affecting another, and to pull out one star is impossible. But there are moments within the stream where the paths divert toward uncertainty. You stand at the precipice, one of a cluster that gleams in the midst of it all. There's a darkness coming for the empire, a darkness rising from the heart of Daxi."
With each word uttered, I can perceive the threads being unwound, stars coursing through the night sky. A different magic from the one I am used to, but magic all the same. How do we stop it?
Jin leans forward then, intent on finding the answers. There is light from the north, but it can easily be smothered by the darkness. The words are cryptic, difficult to understand. But your path will stop here if you do not leave the city tonight. The stars are clear enough. Stay in Jia and you will be extinguished.
The princess rubs her temple with obvious frustration.
Where do I go? Where do the stars lead me?
The way is never clear, Astronomer Wu says apologetically, stroking his beard. Individual destinies are too entwined with one another. A combination of hundreds, thousands of choices. We can only provide guidance, suggest the best course possible, and hope. Hope for the future of the Empire. Hope for peace.
And the guidance for me is to leave. Leave my home, leave my people behind.
Jin turns away, expression darkening.
Run.
She suddenly looks in my direction.
What would you do in my position, Ning? Would you stay and fight for what you have, even though you may fail? Or would you go?
I consider the various interpretations of the astronomer's riddles before offering my thoughts.
If you stay, your name will be recorded in the history books as a princess who fought for her throne and died. You told me your uncle is a master strategist, and you are currently unprepared. He waited for his opportunity. I would do the same. Regroup and return when the time is right.
She ponders this for a moment, then nods. Astronomer Wu seems satisfied by this, and for a moment I feel as if I am standing on the precipice of change he spoke of. The stars diverting, rearranging the course of the Empire, with this one decision. Shadows will follow. Is Jin the target of the darkness, or the origin?
Will you do us the honor of pouring us tea?
Astronomer Wu asks me, pointing to the teaware set out on a table to his right. The water is already warmed on a brazier, ready to pour. The tea leaves smell like smoke and pine, especially pungent. The water releases even more flavors, a faint sweetness reminding me of longan flesh and earthy spice. A mind in turmoil brews bitter drink, so I permit myself to become lost in the process again. I still mourn for my mother's beautiful redwood chest, and someday I will have the ability to recreate it, build a collection I can call my own. But in the meantime, I slip some tea leaves into the pouch in my sash, joining the other pieces I have collected these past days. I don't know what is waiting for us in the journey away from the capital, but I know I will inevitably have to reach for my magic on the road. I bring the cups over to the table. With murmured thanks, they drink the tea, and I can feel the magic already sensing what they need most. Easing tension from their necks and shoulders, smoothing out the lines on their faces.
Thank you.
The astronomer sets his cup down with a sigh.
For you, I would suggest the opposite.
I stare at him, not understanding.
You should stop running. Return to where it all began. You may find the answers you are looking for.
Before I can ask for clarification, there is a knock on the door. Official Tio steps through, worry lines etched on his brow.
Pardon my interruption, but there are soldiers gathering in the tea house below. I do not believe they are aware of your presence, Highness, but it is best you leave before someone recognizes you.
Jin nods and stands to face Astronomer Wu, bowing deeply.
We are grateful for your guidance.
He stands as well, acknowledging her in turn. When we return to the other room, we are given uniforms. Changing behind the screen, we shed the clothing of the palace servants and pull on the soldiers' uniforms instead. I manage a sloppy imitation of a topknot.
Your companion,
I overhear Official Tio's wife speaking to Jin. I had her rest on the bed while you spoke with the esteemed astronomer. Do you want us to take her in as well? We can dress her in our maidservant's uniforms. She does not seem well enough to travel. Jen pulls her hair tight and tucks the helmet under her arm.
No, she states brusquely. She will be coming with us.
Are you certain, Princess? Official Teo says.
You must move swiftly to the docks. The ferry will not wait.
Jin turns on him, eyes flashing fire.
She is my family, and they tried to hurt me through her. I've tried to send her away for her own protection, and she crossed the entire empire to save me. I will never leave her again.
It is difficult to maneuver a barely responsive body down the stairs, but Jin and I somehow manage to balance Ruyi between us and get her back into the cart. I pull the blanket over her while Jin sees to the donkey, readying it for travel.
You there!
A gruff voice sounds behind us. I start, turning around, hastily making sure all of Ruyi is covered. A man steps out from the lit interior of the tea house. A soldier.
What are you doing with that cart?
I blurt out the first thing I can think of.
Grabbing another jar of wine like I was asked.
He frowns.
Wine?
I pull one of the heavy jars from the back, taking the weight on my thighs.
Yes, we were sent on an errand to find more wine. Nothing but the best.
I hope the jars from the palace are not marked in a unique manner or this entire ruse will collapse. He still regards me with suspicion, checking the label to be sure. My legs quiver as if they are made of water, ready to give out at any moment.
Fine,
he finally growls. He gestures to Jin, who ducks her head, hiding her face in the shadows.
You there, grab another jar. We'll make sure our honored guest is served the best.
Who is coming?
I whisper to Jin, who carries the other jar next to me as we ascend the back steps. She shakes her head and stares ahead.
I don't know. Let's set these down somewhere and take our leave.
We are led through the kitchens, where people run back and forth between towers of steaming baskets. A man wields two woks, tossing vegetables expertly over a roaring fire, while a boy squats beside him, feeding the flames. We continue through to the dining area. There are dozens of bodies crowded into the main level of the tea house, some in the black of the city guard, others in brown army uniforms.
More wine!
The soldier who led us inside roars, throwing his arms around our shoulders. The soldiers cheer. We are forced to take off our helmets so as not to appear inconspicuous. The possibility of us slipping away quietly lessens with each step. The heavy pots are taken from us, their seals broken swiftly. The wine is poured into round bowls, much of it spilling out the sides. Somewhere in the room, a group of men break into raucous song.
There's more where it came from!
The soldier releases us, laughing. He tips the bowl into his mouth, dribbling wine down his chin.
Cheers!
They raise their bowls toward us, and before we can protest, we're pulled to sit down on stools at a table. Jen and I exchange uncomfortable looks but continue to play the part. The wine flows freely as the conversation grows louder and the jokes increasingly vulgar. One of the soldiers tells war stories to an attentive audience, while to our left, a drinking game involving rapid hand gestures and curses is in progress. I hold a fake smile on my face as I speak to Jin from the corner of my mouth.
What do we do?
Play along, Jin says, and scoops up a bowl from the table, downing it in one gulp. The man next to her guffaws and slaps her on the back. A city guard raises her bowl to the sky.
Things are changing, my friends. No more patrols. No more chasing after petty thieves. We'll soon be making a decent living. I'll drink to that,
her companion shouts, and they guzzle down more wine. Another soldier stands unsteadily, patchy stubble barely growing on his lip.
I'll make a name for myself.
He slams his foot onto a stool.
They'll call me the Conqueror.
You're drunk, you fool.
A soldier with a grizzled beard roars with laughter, throwing a cup at his head. The young soldier ducks, and the cup hits a man behind him. He turns and glares at our table, which erupts into uproarious laughter. I feel it before I see it, a sudden shift in the air. Around us, the soldiers pull themselves to attention. At first, it's the thud of a single fist on a table. Then it's a steady rhythm, everyone pounding their fists in sync. Jin puts her hand on my arm, bracing herself.
No, she whispers, so close her breath brushes the back of my neck.
I turn to see a man with a commanding presence standing at the entrance to the tea house.
General,
someone calls out, and others echo the title with reverence. He strides in as if the crowds are expected to part before him, as if he knows he will be obeyed. I realize with horror who this must be. The banished prince, the general of Kailong.
Chapter 47. When he turns his head, I can see the blue-black pattern on his face. At the center is the word for exile. The tattoo is meant as an imperial punishment for everyone to see your traitor's mark. But from that word, a defiant pattern emerges, lines curving around his brow and under the jaw. The guards beside him bear similar tattoos, and they wear them with pride, honor to be marked with the same art as their general.
He will recognize me, Jin whispers to me, gripping my arm, as everyone begins to applaud and call out their welcomes. If he sees me, I'm dead.
We slide off our stools to stand with the rest of them. Behind me, there's no clear path to the kitchens, the press of bodies too thick for us to slip away.
Companions,
the general calls out. His voice is warm, resonant over the heads of the crowd.
10 years ago, I was banished from the capital by my own kin. I have despaired at the fall of the Li name, at the struggles of the people. But now it is time for us, my true family, to return and restore Daxi to its former glory.
I am shocked at his impudence. He dares to walk into one of the most prominent tea houses in the capital, showing his face in the city streets without concern. The astronomer was right. Darkness is descending. Something cold touches my arm, and I look down to see that Jin has drawn a dagger, the flat blade pressing against my skin.
Stop,
I hiss at her, while the general begins to make his way through his soldiers, greeting many of them by name. With sinking dread, I realize he is pouring each person a drink, adding something from the flask at his side. The stories always said he commanded the loyalties of his battalions easily, and it's apparent in how he treats his soldiers with respect and acknowledgement.
You can't possibly think you would be able to walk out of here alive if you try to kill him,
I whisper to Jin, placing my hand over the blade.
He's the one who orchestrated my father's poisoning,
she snarls.
I will watch him bleed with my knife in his chest.
I, for one, want to live. I want to find the antidote for my sister. I want to see the plateaus of Kala with Lian. I want to stand on the peaks of Heaven's Gate and peer into a different kingdom. The general is getting closer, and I reach for the only thing I have, my magic. I pull the pouch from my sash. With a twist of my hand, I drop my bowl on the table, spilling most of my drink. I pick up the neglected pot of tea, and it's still half full. Not many are interested in tea with the wine so abundant. Better for me. I break the pieces of tangerine peel and also use my fingernail to grate slivers of golden root into the tea. The general is 20 paces away and fast approaching. I thrust my elbow into Jin's side, forcing her to lower the knife. I pour half my bowl of tea into hers, placing my hand around her own. The bowls begin to warm under my hands, and Jin jumps beside me, assuring me she feels it as well.
Follow my lead, I tell her through clenched teeth, praying she will obey.
The general stands in front of us. I stare down at my hands.
Friends,
he nods, pouring something from a flask into our bowls. A sprinkling of unfamiliar fine powder. I do not know what it is, if it will interfere with my magic, but there is no other choice. We drink. I taste the powder first, gliding against my tongue. There's a nuttiness to it, quickly washed away by the flavor of the tea. The magic flares to life, pulsing strongly inside me, more powerful than I have ever experienced. I think about animals, crouched behind leaves. I think about mist obscuring our features. We look familiar, but no one you can name.
You.
The general's eyes narrow. His attention is drawn to Jin's face.
I recognize you. We are honored to meet you,
I say, the magic changing my voice, lowering the tone. I sound 10 years older. Pressing my arm against Jin's body, I can feel the magic humming through us, changing our features, forming the ones he wants to see. The general of Kailong meets my eyes, and I can see myself reflected in them. A girl. A woman. Terrified. Calm. The liquid in my bowl begins to move, although the general does not notice. It winds itself into the figure of a three-headed snake, rippling on the surface. Ghostly whispers join the hideous omen. I struggle to compose my face, to hold my head still and not look for the source of the noise.
May the sea be willing.
I manage to force out the words of Kong's blessing, even as the whispers grow louder and my unease deepens. Something whistles in the distance, a long, malevolent note. The general blinks. My reflection disappears from his eyes and he smiles.
May the sea be willing,
he echoes and turns away. I almost collapse onto my stool as the drunken revelry around us resumes. A man stumbles into me, a vial of the same powder the general had given us rolling out of his pocket. It comes to a stop near my foot. I pick it up, noticing the gray tinge. This must be the pearl powder Kong spoke of, revered among his people.
Wine, more wine,
someone else calls out.
We'll get more.
Jin stands, the magic still changing her voice so that she sounds like a hardened soldier. Her features waver, the illusion melding to her face. I pray that it holds long enough for us to leave, and I shove the vial into the pouch with my other things. We pass through the heat of the kitchens, and I gulp in the cold night air when we exit the back door. I know how narrowly we've just escaped death. We have to get to the ferry, Jin says, maintaining her composure much better than me. There's no more time. Our transport will leave at the hour of the rooster. Help me sit her up. While Jin pulls Ru Yi to a seated position, I pop the seal from one of the wine jugs and splash the wine over her still body. Before the princess can protest, I reassure her. We'll pretend to be drunkards. Taking hold of her, we stagger toward the port, moving as quickly as we dare. Emerging from the market district, we pass a procession of palace guards on horseback. At the center, a young man sits astride his horse, posture tall and clad in armor that is a striking pattern of black and gold. When we walk by, I cannot help but lift my head to look at him, only to see him watching me in return. No, it couldn't be. I quickly drop my head. I recognize those eyes, that mouth. The son of the banished prince, soon to be reunited with his father. We are so close, and Kong could easily rouse the attention of his guards, send them chasing after us. I can feel his gaze, burning through the back of my head. But no hoofbeats follow us to the pier, and no one else stops three soldiers, stinking of wine, slurring nonsense. We arrive at the boat just as the criers call out the hour of the rooster, and after flashing official Tio's seal, The captain allows us to board.
We'll set off at once,
Jin instructs. Move south along the Jade River until given other directions. The captain nods, and soon after we set sail away from the port. Away from Jia. Away from Kong.
Chapter 48. We're shown to our quarters on the lower level of the ship, and we heave Ruyi onto the narrow bed. Jin sinks to the bench, all the strength gone from her.
Where do we go?
She whispers.
What do I do?
She looks less like a princess and more like a scared girl. Not much older than me. I'd forgotten she's only 19. Sitting down as well, I try to find encouraging words to speak to her, but find none. All I have to offer is more bad news, more warnings. In our haste to leave the city, I had one remaining piece of information I realized now I have yet to pass on to her, and I hope at least it will help her retain her focus. I spoke with Wen Yi in the dungeons, I inform her, pulling out the pouch from my sash. He said Ye Liu is still loyal to the Emperor, but Han Xia may have gone to the rebellion. I place the items on the small table between us. The vial, shoes embroidery, father's letter, mother's knot, a few petals of osmanthus and strands of tea leaves. I pick up the two squares of paper from Wen Yi and unfold one of them. Quickly reading the words, I confirm that this is the letter with reference to the disappearances Wen Yi spoke of, and pass it to her.
Wen Yi, why did you not bring him with you?
Jin reads the words with renewed interest. He could have been a benefit to our cause. I'm sure he would have liked to be able to tell you himself, but he passed in the night. Jin glances at me, expression softening. You have risked it all, Ning, and for that I am grateful. While she reads, I pick up Shu's embroidery again, running my finger over the stitches. The beauty of the peony reminds me of the tea house we escaped from, and also that entertainer who assisted me in the second round of the competition. I never managed to get her name. The moon represents me, I am certain, her love stitched into this fabric. We must go to Ye Liu, Jin says to me, worry drawing down the corners of her eyes after taking in what was revealed in Wen Yi's letter. If we speak to the monks there, they may provide more information on what Wen Yi has shared with us. If what he says is true, then the poison must have originated from Han Xia. I still have more questions than answers, but Jin instructs me to get some rest instead. She lies down next to Ruyi while I curl up on the bench. The candle sputters next to me and casts long, leaping shadows in the wall as restless thoughts run through my mind. My heart is torn, knowing the decision I must make tomorrow, when the ship will continue south, then turn west at Nanjiang. We will be passing through Su and close to my village. Do I follow the princess, knowing the brilliant minds at Ye Liu may have the answers that will lead me to the antidote? Or do I listen to my father's pleas and return home? The chancellor had said he was certain a Shen Nongshi was the culprit behind the tea bricks. But was that a lie? And how did he get the magic arrow that poisoned Ruyi? I saw the three-headed snake again when I shared the tea with the general. What is Shen Nong trying to tell me? If the poison is from Han Xia, then why would a component of the poison be seaweed from Liu Zhou? Sleep continues to elude me, and I sit up again, quietly growling in frustration. I look down at my hand, realizing I've crumbled Shu's embroidery in my fist, holding it close to my heart like a talisman. Smoothing out the fabric, my eyes catch on the peculiar color of the grass again, rippling strangely, as if moving in water. Then the spots on the stunted branches of the trees. Holes. Not trees. Coral. I recognize it now. Seaweed. The moon reflected. The poem. I've been looking at it all wrong. The moon is in the water. This is not my sister reminding me of home.
She knew Father would not allow her to continue her experiments for the antidote, so she sent me an outline of her discoveries. This is a recipe. Sweeping the scrolls off the small table, I find ink and paper, and I begin to write. I wake to quiet voices, my face resting against my notes on the table. I wipe the drool from the corner of my mouth with my sleeve as the words swim in front of my eyes. As sleep retreats, panic sets in, shooting through me as I hurry to the porthole, clutching the paper to my chest, afraid we have traveled too far. I see the busy port where we are currently docked. I've slept all day while we traveled down the river. The tower in the distance, brilliantly lit against the night, is one I recognize. Nanjiang. I feel something sag inside me with relief, and I steady myself against the wall. It's not too late. Ning? I turn to see Jin and Ruyi looking at me with worry. I show them everything I've found. Shu's discoveries. And how I believe I may be in possession of the missing piece of the antidote. They look at each other, silent communication passing between them. Then Jin turns to me with a nod. We will help you in any way we are able. I had thought Jin would insist upon traveling to Yelio first, in order to act on the knowledge from Wen Yi's letter, or Ruyi would be the one to doubt my abilities, but they continue to surprise me. Thank you, I tell them, voice hoarse with emotion. I'm returning to Su. I'm ready to go home. On the road back home, I ponder the strangeness of the direction my life has taken. Sitting astride a horse behind the fearsome shadow, who I thought was my enemy, following a princess who may soon be heir to nothing. My agitation grows as we approach the village. What waits for me at home terrifies me more than waiting for my death in the dungeons. I must reach Shu before it's too late, and the antidote must work against the poison. I cannot imagine any other possibility. We take the road around the village, avoiding as many people as possible. I leave Jin and Ruyi in my mother's grove of pomelo trees, knowing her spirit will protect them. Picking up my skirts, I run down the familiar road, climbing up Philosopher's Hill, the moon lighting my way home. As I cut through the tea garden, the trees welcome me. Hearing them now, I know it's not my childish imagination.
Hurry, hurry!
Their whispers chase me down the next hill until I see the rise of our roof. My hand clenches tightly around the curve of the vial containing the pearl powder. The door flies open beneath my hand, thudding against the table. My footsteps thunder through our front room. I brush aside the bead curtain to see Father looking up from dabbing Shu's face with a damp cloth, and my breath catches. It's just enough hesitation to see the emotions that flit across my father's face. Relief, sadness, regret. In the pale moonlight trailing through our windows, my father looks much older than when I left him. Haggard lines are worn deep into the crevices of his face. He looks worse than after we buried Mother, as if he hasn't slept since I've been gone.
Ning?
He asks, and his voice is as rough as his appearance.
Are you a ghost?
I kneel at his side, taking Shu's hand in mine. Her head is turned away from me, but she seems to sense I am near. She turns to face me, eyes glassy and unseeing.
Mother?
She rasps out. I can smell the sickness on her breath. Her lips are cracked and bleeding.
It's me, I tell her. It's Ning. I've come back.
Mother,
she begins to cry.
You're back. I missed you so much.
I look up at Father, alarmed.
How long has she been like this?
A few days now, he says, shaking his head. On and off. I try to get the fever down, but it returns. There have been a few nights I've found her wandering outside. I've had to tie her down to keep her from leaving. He chokes back a sob. That's when I look at her wrists and see the red marks there. A swell of anger rises inside me. Then I notice his red-rimmed eyes, the stains on his tunic from blood, vomit, and who knows what else. I force myself to channel my fury at the poison. My father did not cause this, and all the angry words in the world will not bring my mother back. But I might yet be able to save my sister. "I think I have the antidote," I say to him. "I can purge the poison from her." "Tell me." He grips my arm, some clarity returning to his gaze. "Tell me what to do. I will help you." He doesn't question me like he usually does. He stands, awaiting instruction. "I need Lilu and licorice root," I tell him, "as well as mother's spring tea leaves. I know we have tea leaves from more recent harvests, but there is nothing that would compare to the leaves she prepped with her own hands." My teaware still remains on the shelf in the main room, covered in a layer of dust. Returning back to our room, I look around our home with new eyes. Compared to the luxuries of the palace, the surroundings are worn and tired. No delicately carved screens, no incense emanating from braziers that can be lit day and night. But the woven knot I made for luck still dangles by the window, bleached pale from the sun. There's the crack in her mirror from the time Shu and I were chasing each other and I fell against it, knocking it over. The worn pattern on the doorway where the bead curtain rubs against the frame, the one Shu always imagined looked like a dragon, calling it our door guardian. Something squeezes in my chest. A hand sweeps the bead curtain aside again as my father steps in, bringing over everything I've asked for from the storeroom. I touch my own tools. The bamboo, the wood, the pot with my fingerprints on the curve, and the misshapen lid that never quite fit right. But it's all mine. This is where I'm from. I had to come back before I could move forward, the astronomer said. I place the ingredients into the bowl, the moon reflected in the sea. Each component of the poison has its own mirror in the antidote. Dried lilu, thin strands, smelling of soil, slowing down the heart, opposing the invigorating properties of the white peony root, weakening the grip of the poison. Licorice, sliced into thin pieces, mitigating the toxicity of the yellow quinbu. Pearl powder, the missing component. Shu had thought it was coral, balancing and stabilizing the antidote, difficult to obtain so far inland. But it was something even more rare and unexpected, for the pearls have fallen out of favor, and the general of Kailang designed a poison that would not harm his own people. I tasted it in the shared cup, recognized its power in strengthening hidden magics. Allowing it to steep, I turn instead to the tea leaves brewing, lifting the lid off the pot. It smells like spring, like sprouts emerging from the soil, reaching for the next sprinkle of rain. I pour it over the medicinal ingredients. When I bring the bowl to my lips, I can almost feel the brush of white wings against my cheek. The soothing warmth runs down my throat, spreads through my entire body. The shift comes easily, without need of the den, even while Shu is lost in her dreaming. Because she is my sister. I was there on the day she was born, our connection built upon our intertwined lives. I can see her these past few weeks, poring over father's books, with her chin cradled in her hand, pulling herbs from the garden in secret, watching for me and father to appear over the hill. Furtive scribblings on slips of paper, shoved into a drawer or tucked underneath a basket. Not jasmine, not ginseng. The poison does not respond to bleeding. But she found something that resonated with the small bit of Li Lu she ingested, and she suspected the white peony root to be the culprit. There was no way of getting word to me without father becoming suspicious, so she stitched the hidden message into the embroidery. The poison made her confused, made it difficult to focus. She saw strange images sometimes, heard whispers in an empty room. Figures emerged from the mist, dreams crossing into reality. Birds with human legs, butterflies with blinking eyes in their wings. A giant serpent with golden scales, hissing her name. The pearl powder courses through my body like lightning, sending me through her memories and into the present, where I find her wandering through a grove of trees.
"Shu,"
I call, but she does not seem to hear me. I follow her into the mist, running after her through the forest, like I've done so many times before. The trees are shadows, rustling beside us as I give chase. She stops at the bottom of our favorite tree and turns back, beckoning me to come closer. She's already climbing when I reach her, ascending quickly. We used to play this game as children, daring the other to climb higher. I can see her feet dangling above me. Shu waves.
"I'm up here."
My hands touch the bark. It feels real against my palms. I start to climb, finding the next branch, pulling myself higher and higher. But still she remains one step ahead, just out of reach. I know, with an awareness of the goddess whispering to me, that if she breaks through the canopy, she will be lost to me forever. I climb faster. I hear a whistle, like the wind of an approaching storm. That discordant, piercing note I heard when I saw myself reflected in the eyes of a general. Above us, a dark shadow descends. As it comes closer, it draws itself together into a dark, undulating form. A serpent with a long, forked tongue and fangs curving from the corner of its mouth. The red points of its eyes bleed hunger. Shu perches on a branch to my right, frozen in fear before this creature that has haunted her since I left. I should have been here to protect her. Branches and leaves fall around us like rain. I feel the brush of the serpent's hunger against my mind, like that of the three-headed snake I tore out of Ruyi. It looms overhead, red eyes appearing like polished orbs. I can see my reflection within them. It sees me and wonders what I am.
"You,"
it hisses in recognition. It does not speak aloud, but instead its voice rings through my head.
"I've seen you before, in the palace."
Every word it utters is like a sharp pinprick of ice, driving itself into my skull. But when it speaks, it gives me glimpses of what it is as well. It attached a piece of itself to the arrow that pierced Ruyi's side, creating the three-headed monster that feasted on her essence. I see the answers to the questions I've been asking all along. Why the poison was undetectable even by the most experienced Shen Nongshi? Why the royal physicians could not find the antidote? It's because this poison was created by something else entirely, something ancient and waiting, biding its time.
"Shen Nong,"
it snarls, revealing its sharp fangs. It hates Shen Nong and all his followers. It despises the old gods and all humankind, everything they represent. It lunges toward Shu, wanting to swallow her whole, to satisfy the hunger it feels after she eluded it time and time again. I don't hesitate. I throw myself in the serpent's path. Its fangs sink into my skin and I scream.
"Ning!"
Shu cries out and catches my hand. Our fingers reach each other, take hold, and she pulls me toward her. My arm is wrenched out of the grasp of the serpent, and we fall through the tree, the branches snapping under our weight, whipping and lashing at our exposed skin. I hang onto her tightly, protecting her with my own body. The serpent slithers down the tree, following. I close my eyes, both of us tensing, waiting for the inevitable impact, and return to my own body, my face wet with tears.
"Ning?"
Shu struggles to sit up. Beside us, our father cries too, sobbing like I've never seen him before. I hurry to her bedside, holding the bowl up to her lips. She drinks it with eyes still on me, disbelieving.
"I dreamed,"
she says with awe.
"I dreamed you came to find me."
I smile through my tears. "I promised you I would come back, didn't I?" There's a shadow enveloping Daxi, and a princess waiting for me in a grove of pomelo trees. But in this moment, nothing else matters. My sister is alive. Then father is suddenly there, holding my arm up. Two trails of blood mark where my skin was broken by the serpent's fangs. Black tendrils slither across my skin like poisonous, choking vines. The bowl slips out of my hand and lands on the floor with a clatter. Shu's face is the last thing I remember as the darkness sweeps me away. This is Carolyn Kang. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Magic Steeped in Poison by Judy I. Lin. This program was directed by Carlin Daigle. Executive producer, Nithya Rajendran. Text copyright 2022 by Judy I. Lin. Production copyright 2022 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.